micro-foundations in the sense that it provides us with a set of categories and ways of thinking about how individuals as real persons are formed into participants and collective actors. Individuals as incumbents and positions are formed into participants and collective actions. The general framework I'm going to use goes under the name game theory. Radicals often are scandalized by the use of game theory. To some extent, it might even be for the trivial reason that the word game seems a little frivolous and, you know, too playful. It's not good for the serious business of revolution and transformation. I also think it comes from an unsatisfactory understanding of what the point of game theory is and why classical revolutionary theorists were all implicit game theorists. You know, Marx, Lenin, Engels, all of these classical theorists of social change, I think, implicitly adopted game theory ideas. As we'll see, Lenin's theory of cadre and the importance of a particular kind of party organization can be thought of as a solution to a game theory problem, in which he had a particular theory of the role of leadership within collective actions, which fits perfectly well within the models that game theorists talk about. I'm not going to review the prisoner's dilemma as the iconic, simple example of a game theory problem. I assume that everybody has encountered this enough that they know what the prisoner's dilemma is all about. If not, you should be sure to, you know, read my notes on it, which I think explain it well enough, because it will be an idea that we'll be working with quite a bit. Yeah.
Just a quick question about game theory. I believe, is it specifically often used for individualism? I think I know of cases where groups are put in the game and not just individuals.
Right, so you can certainly put collectivities in the game. We'll be discussing some work of Adam Shavorsky where he takes collectivities as the entities that are in the game. Any serious game theorist who does that realizes that they're actually dealing with a nested game theory. That is, there's a game theory problem for why individuals are participating in the collectivity, as well as a game theory problem for how the collectivities interact. So there's two game theory problems, and it's just that they're bracketing one and focusing on the other. Whenever you have a game theory model of the form, unions are a collective actor, and they're in a game with employers, you know, so that you're looking at those two kinds, or the state, or whatever. It implies that you've already solved, or at least are bracketing, the question of why are the union members, why are they members? How is that problem solved?
Isn't it possible that there's sort of the assumption that these groups are more rational than individuals?
No. There's no reason to imagine that collective entities have higher capacity for rationality than individuals. Or less capacity. That will, I think, depend entirely contextually. The American military as a collectivity seems to have enormous capacity for irrationality in the sense of having inflated expectations about what it can accomplish under different conditions. You know, its fantasies about Afghanistan are not based on rational understanding of the causes and constraints of powerful Western powers being able to control particular kinds of peoples and territories. Right? So either they're lying, they know that this is hopeless, but they have other reasons for doing it anyway, or they're subject to wishful thinking, which is a form of irrationality. I suspect it's wishful thinking. You know, I think that the neocons are a combination of absolute malevolent, you know, nasties and deluded fantasists. You know, they have fantasies about what they could accomplish. The Iraq war, in which they had the slogan, the shortest route to Tehran is through Baghdad is a fantasy. Now, one, even if it was not a fantasy, one could object to it on other grounds. But in addition to it being objectionable on moral grounds, it's objectionable on grounds of a failure of rationality. Okay, so I want to just very briefly review the objections to rational choice that one finds among critical theorists, progressives, Marxists, feminists, and others, and just show why I think the objections are incorrect. They're missing the point. If their objections diagnosed correctly the character of rational choice theory and game theory, then they would be legitimate. It's just that they're misdiagnoses. They reflect a misunderstanding of the nature of these theoretical constructions. I should add, before I just quickly go through these, there are plenty of game theorists who encourage this misconception. So, that is, there are certain people who do game theory who themselves misunderstand game theory. That is, they treat these as actual models of the way people really behave rather than as useful devices for clarifying a set of problems, which then enable us to explain how people act and interact. Okay, so the three objections that people make about game theory is that it assumes that actors are egoists, only self-interested. It assumes that they are hyper-rational. And it assumes that actions are mainly to be explained by intentions and choice. Taken together, those three criticisms are that rational choice theory and game theory are highly individualistic and based on a particularly distorted view of individuals, namely that they are hyper-rational, self-interested choosers. Each of these criticisms, I think, are incorrect. First, about egoism. There's no assumption at all in game theory that people are factually selfish, that they are motivated only by self-interest. It may be a methodological postulate that a sensible place to begin analyzing a complex problem of strategic interaction is to begin by seeing how in these contexts people would act if they were selfish. So it could be that selfishness is a useful starting point for an analysis of social interactions, but it's strictly a heuristic device. Jan Elster emphasizes this, that to begin with an assumption of selfishness is simply a simplifying assumption in order to develop a particular kind of model that might help us understand something. It's not a hypothesis. It's not a hypothesis about how the world is. It's an assumption for a model which enables us to form hypotheses about how the world is. But the hypotheses may be about all the way people are altruistic. I think that game theory, in these terms, beginning with a model of selfishness, helps us to more deeply understand non-selfishness. It more deeply enables us to understand altruism and how altruism actually works. It's purely a methodological assumption for a starting point for analysis. Why is it a good starting point? Because it's simple-minded. Simple-minded starting points are better than hyper-complex starting points. Secondly, rationality. Now, the expression rational choice theory is, I think, deeply misleading because it implies that there is a hard assumption of rationality. In fact, game theory does not assume that people act rationally. Rational and non-rational and irrational, so we simplify again cognitive processes and say people can be rational, irrational, and irrational, that is, they can have cognitive processes that are neither rational nor irrational, are all part of actual human cognition, And in different settings, one or another of these may dominate, maybe the most important. The claim is merely that to understand the importance of these non-rational processes, it's useful to clarify what rational action would look like. In order to give precision to all the ways in which we may act irrationally, it's useful to have as a template, as a background baseline model, how people would act if they were acting rationally, where rationally means that they are acting in ways that optimize their chances of achieving their interests given their information, as opposed to acting in ways that undercut their interests given the information. Yeah, Joe.
What do you mean by irrational?
Well, people may simply act on the basis of conventions, which are neither rational nor irrational, non-rational, irrational. It just means that rationality isn't in play in there.
A basic convention of like a social convention?
Yeah. And you could say it's rational to act conventionally, but it's not a cognitive process. It's not a question of people thinking about it. Yeah.
Can the framework conceptualize multiple normative orientations at the same time in the same actor?
Sure. And it can conceptualize very context-dependent forms of preferences, for example. I mean, you said normative orientation is a complex idea. One interpretation is simply a way of describing your preferences. Another is that it's a separate process. It's not preferences. It's something else that put constraints on your behavior within which you form your preferences. So I don't think at this point we need to kind of parse exactly what norms are doing or what values are doing in the cognitive processes of people. Game theory is a theory of cognition. That is, it's looking at people's actions in terms of cognitive processes, how they make choices, form intentions, and do so either in ways that are self-interested or interested in others. Norms can affect, for example, the formation of their interests or preferences, or norms could directly enter into their cognition and not be about the formation of their preferences. But there's nothing in game theory which stipulates any particular values or norms that people might hold. Yeah?
Could you clarify on specific meaning of rationality? Because you were talking about how some terms are problematic and that they create the image of like this scholar in a white ivory tower imposing definitions of or conceptions of what is right or wrong, or in this case, what's rational and irrational.
In game theory, rationality refers to what perhaps more philosophical discussions would be called instrumental rationality. You know, rationality is itself a very complex idea. It has lots of forms of rationality, lots of dimensions to it. But instrumental rationality means, given a goal, what's the best way of accomplishing it? There may be multiple best ways, in which case rationality will not distinguish among them. So there may be two different ways to do something, both of which are equally good. That is, equally good in the sense that they have the same probability of accomplishing what the person wants, what the goal is, and they do so with the same expenditure of resources and energy. So there are when you ask what's the most rational thing to do, what you're asking is, given your goals, given what you want to accomplish, what's the best way of accomplishing it? Now, it's of course always given the goals and the information you have. One way in which you may act suboptimally is that given the information, you did the best thing, but you had bad information. Right? So that would be a failure of the rationality of the action, but not a failure of your cognitive processes. You were acting rationally, but you produced a non-rational result because you had bad information. the problem of information then enters into these accounts in a very important ways, as we will see. Information turns out to be a very thick idea, really important for these things. And it becomes even more interesting because actors know they need information. People, as we're all very good at this process of making choices and thinking about what we want to do, and we know we need information for it. So one of our choices is about how to get the information. Now you can see immediately you get into a loop that to make a perfectly rational choice you need perfect information. To get that information requires choices. You have to spend your time and energy to get the information. But it would be irrational to spend all your time and energy getting the perfect information in order to make a choice, because you'd never make the choice then. You know, you want to buy a house. In order to buy the best house for the amount of money to make the rational choice, you need to get all the information possible about all the houses that are available and about all their repair records and whether they have secret mold in the walls. And, you know, and so you could spend all your money with inspections on all the houses you want to buy and then not have any money left over to buy a house, so to speak. That would be irrational. But to buy a house without good information is also irrational. This is a situation in which theorists of these things say the optimal strategy is what's called bounded rationality, where you seek enough information to avoid making really bad decisions. You get enough information in order to make a good enough decision, where good enough means there's some standard of error that you want to avoid. But good enough isn't the best possible decision. But that's because it's costly to get the information. Now, you know, it turns out that this little word information, once economists figured out that it mattered, which wasn't that long ago. I mean, this is only the last 25 years or so, that information. Once you introduce information into these problems, they completely fall apart. They get really complicated and interesting. It's because of this problem of information, actually, that there's a very big place for sociology in all of these discussions, because a lot of what we talk about is how people solve, you know, uses language necessarily, how people solve some of these information problems. Yeah.
So, understanding your point in part two here, of rationality, so there could be a specific game where, let's say, for example, there is a rational choice and an irrational choice, and the actor chooses the irrational, but because they didn't have the information, they acted rationally,
yeah,
given their information. Yeah.
And what we would want to do, we want to diagnose, so we observe, we have this nice model, and it says what people should do if they're acting rationally. And we observe that they're not doing that. And then we want, that says, aha, if our model of what they should do if they acted rationally is a good model, and they act irrationally, we have a problem then to solve. This points our research to say, why did they act irrationally? Is it because they have bad information? Is it because they're psychotic? It could be. Is it because they have cultural views which say that it is disgusting to act in a particular way? They have abhorrence, there's taboos. You know, what is the mechanism that's having them act in a way which is subverting their own purposes? Remember, it's given the goals they have, they're not acting in the optimal way. Now, it could be that after studying this, you realize that what you thought were their goals weren't their goals. Could be that the error was in your initial description. So your initial description says, aha, we know what they want to accomplish. They want good health for their children. But they're acting in ways which is subverting the health of their children. What's going on? You then study it carefully and you discover that they just told you that they cared about the health of their children. Actually, that wasn't very important to them. They had other goals, their own personal pleasure. Turned out to be their real goals, and whenever there was a conflict between what gave them pleasure and what was good for their children, they always opted for what gave them pleasure. Well, there's nothing irrational in that. There's nothing irrational in not caring about the health. It's nasty. But from the point of view of a rational actor model, if your goal is to have pleasure, then what their choices are might be the optimal choices for that, even if it's subverted these other goals. What the rational actor models do is enable you to diagnose whether the reason for the activity, the action, the choices of the actors, to give precision to this, is because of the character of the goals they're pursuing, the character of their cognitive processes, or the character of the information that they have. And of course, if you're interested in social change, and you're interested in why aren't people joining this union when it would clearly be in their interest to do so, and you diagnose it because that they've got all this bad information about it, that's a much simpler problem to solve than if it's because they have a different conception of what's in their interests to begin with. Yeah, John.
Inside the game, and I guess philosophically, I don't see the arena that irrational thought is getting carved out of. I mean, like, so if I'm standing in front of a door, I can either run into the door thinking I'm going to get through it, that's irrational, or open the door, and that's rational. Irrational seems to be just standing in front of the door.
Well, let's drop I toss the irrational in there without meaning for that to be a hook for some deep ideas.
Sorry.
So, no, it's okay. I mean, it's my...
I'm really confused by it.
Right. So, let's just stick with rational and irrational for the moment.
Would an example of that be like, why, when you go to Europe, why do you drive on the left side of the street? Because you're following the convention to drive on the side of the street.
Well, but it's a rational product.
It's rational, so you have your car. So.
Yeah, it's perfectly rational for you to drive on the side of the street that everybody else is.
Yeah.
And there's only an historical explanation for why in Europe people drive on the on the side of the street they do, and in England it's the opposite. It's because of Napoleon. You know the story of the side of the street that you drive on? It used to be that everybody rode horses on the left side. Drove on the left, and that was so that your right hand would be visible to an approaching horseman, because your right hand would be a hand that might hold a weapon. And so the convention was that if you approach somebody, they could see that you were not a threat if you ride on the left side. Whereas if you ride on the right side, they can't see that, right? It's not as, they can't see it. Well, Napoleon, as part of his effort at pacifying Europe and creating uniform standards, switched it all to the right side. The reason why Sweden and Britain still, Sweden recently, in the last 25 years, switched sides of the road, because Napoleon didn't conquer Sweden or England. The places he didn't conquer stayed on the left. The places he did conquer switched to the right.
And Cyprus too. England, Cyprus.
What?
Cyprus, they also ride on the left side. That comes through
England. Same with Australia and New Zealand.
That Sweden story is really interesting. They did it in a day. One day they were
switched.
Day they were right. In a day, overnight, they did this huge poke ad campaign.
And it was like, successful. They were really
successful. It's like one of the great marvels of like public propaganda or whatever.
I want to get through the. these are pretty simple points, but I would like to get through them as long as. But we can. I think there's time for a couple of short questions and this clarification, David.
Well, I just wanted to mention a couple of the problems with game theory that I've heard, some of which that you've already raised. First one is the infinite regress problem, which is that I'm supposed to act strategically, and that requires me to imagine your strategic actions, which circles back to me. And I guess the problem is, if there's supposed to be an equilibrium solution, it might require me to infinitely think back and forth.
Right.
And the claim is that there is no equilibrium, or there is no solution to that problem. The second one is what you're talking about with respect to information, i.e. rationality doesn't, you know, a rational actor doesn't, rationality doesn't necessarily tell the rational actor how much information to collect is the rational amount of information to collect. And the last one that I've heard is with respect to the goal. So Kenneth Arrow makes this point that this form of rationality is specifically instrumental, i.e. how we go about attaining the goal, given the goal, but the goal itself is not necessarily under the scrutiny of rationality. So once the goal is that we are to build a wall, then it's, you know, how do you go about doing it rationally, but the question of building the wall in the first place is not necessarily
right. So none of those points, I think, are criticisms, actually potent criticisms against developing these kinds of models, because none of these criticisms imply that we can't learn very important things through the simplifying assumptions that we make in these models. The criticism that would matter is if we can't learn anything from these. That is, if they don't help us more clearly identify real causal processes in the world. So, for example, it is true that for perfect, complete, pure rationality, I not only have to anticipate what you think, but what you think that I think. And then since I know you're thinking about what I think, I have to think about how you think about what I think, and so on. So you get this infinite regress. Well, that's fine. That means you can't have a complete model that has all of those elements. But you can have a model which says, let's first suppose that I know what you think. Now let's suppose that I just have a probabilistic view of what you think. And you can, you know, add complexity. And at some point, the complexity becomes too complex, and you say, I can't have a theoretical model beyond this level of complexity. That's as far as I can go with my theoretical model. Let's see what we can learn about particular social problems in context with this theoretical model. And there may be then additional more ad hoc things that I will add to my explanations as a result. I don't see any problem with that. And I don't know what the alternative is. The alternative is to have such ideas in your head and just not share them with other people. I think everybody who has ever studied these kinds of problems has implicitly something like a game theory model. Marx certainly did. Lenin did. And the question is whether you tell other people what your model is and then try to improve it, or whether you keep it to yourself. Because everybody thinks that people make choices, that they have goals, they try to achieve those goals, and they do so taking account of other people. That's all this is doing that, talking about those things systematically rather than informally. Just the final point on this initial list of criticisms, choice versus constraint. There's absolutely nothing in game theory as such which says that the real explanatory power comes from the choices people make as opposed to the constraints under which they make those choices. Game theory says that social action takes place in an environment of strategic choices within constraints. That's what it's about. It's a set of models about making strategic choices within constraints. That's the framework. But it doesn't say that in the world the constraints are very loose, so there's extremely wide ranges of choices to be made, or the constraints are very tight. It says that that's a variation in the world that's relevant to explaining particular things. But the explanation still takes the form of strategic choice within constraint. So I think that basically, if you believe that action is strategic, if you believe that people engage in actions individually and collectively, understanding that other people are doing the same thing, so you believe that there is strategy involved, then you're basically adopting implicitly game theory. I actually prefer the term strategic interaction theory. I think that's the best, that'd be a more accurate label. These are strategic interaction models. But game theory is the term that's gotten used. Now, to understand the value of this kind of theory, this way of modeling people's activities, I think it's worthwhile to contrast it with two simpler kinds of accounts of human action, or of human activity, if you will. This is on page 6 and 7 of the notes. So here's three different ways you can look at what people do. You want to explain why people do what they do. One explanation is that we are all engaged in scripted behavior. We are players on a stage, you know, fretting and strutting, signifying nothing, if you read Macbeth. We're filling roles. The term role, it's interesting in sociology, the term role applies both to plays in the theater and to society. And the imagery is meant to be evocative of a role in a play. In a drama, you're given a script and you do it well if you follow the script well, and you do it badly if you don't. You off your lines. So one view of human behavior, human action, is that our action is scripted. Our norms and roles govern our behavior. So our behavior is governed by the script. It's all glorified habit, basically. There are places in Bourdieu which come very close to this. The notion habitus is meant to invoke habit, the formation of habits that become so embodied and so routine that people are basically acting out the scripts that have been internalized.
This is also Goffman.
Well, lots of sociologists have that as an element, and I don't reject this. I think a lot of behavior is scripted. I don't think these are choices. These are just alternative. This is part of our menu of explaining behavior and action and practices. So one part of our menu is that a lot of our action is scripted. We do things just because we've learned the roles well. Another kind of explanation is that action is intentional. That is, people have purposes which they formed in their minds. They have intentions. And make choices based on their intentions. The choices can be goal-driven or norm-driven. Goal-driven means you have something you want to accomplish, and you make a choice to accomplish it. Norm-driven means that you have an awareness of certain values or norms that you want to conform to, and you choose actions that conform to a norm. It's not so much a goal to accomplish. These are more like constraints you put on yourselves for how you behave. Goal-driven means that it's all instrumental, and norm-driven means that it's conforming to some standard. It may not always be obvious, you know, which is going on. The key issue here is that you are acting under constraints in your environment, but these constraints, whether they are material constraints or these norms, these are taken as fixed and given. Action is intentional, it may be rational, but it isn't strategic. Now, what strategic action says is, it's not just that you make choices under constraints, but you know that other actors are also making choices under constraints. Our choices, therefore, have to take into conscious consideration in one way or another the likely choices of others. You have to think about how other people are thinking. You're not just intentional actors, you are strategic actors. This isn't just being rational. You can be rational when you go into a store and buy a chocolate bar. You have a craving for chocolate. You know you like certain kinds of sweets and not others. You go to the store, you look at what's on offer, and you pick the one that will satisfy your preferences the most. That's a rational action. It's intentional. But it's not strategic. It's not an action in which you have to take into consideration anybody else's actions. You're just doing what you want to do to satisfy a particular need. A strategic action means that in deciding what to do, you have to think about what other people are going to do. Social conflicts are always embedded in strategic action. You know, the actions of a protest movement always take into consideration the likely actions of police, the likely actions of bystanders, the likely actions of legislatures. They are trying to affect the actions of others, and therefore they have to take into consideration in making their own choices what the choices of others will be. That kind of interdependence is exactly what game theory is meant to do. And that kind of interdependence is exactly what the account of class formation and class conflict wants to accomplish. And that's partially why I think that there's a nice affinity between these two sets of problems, the substantive problem of class formation and class struggle, and the theoretical apparatus of game theory. Just one final quick point. So the essential point of this all is that we have strategic interaction, where the actions of one person are interdependent upon the actions of others. This interdependency in game theory can be broken down into three kinds of interdependencies, which Jan Elster lays out in his piece, Marxism, Functionalism, and Game Theory, which one of the pieces assigned for this section of the course. He breaks this down in terms of the interdependencies among the choices and rewards that different people in a interaction, a strategic interaction situation, have. Rewards can be anything. Rewards in this language can be material welfare, feelings of pride, good feelings towards others. It could be the well-being of others. I mean, you know, rewards is a perfectly generic term. It's just whatever you want to accomplish through your choices and actions. And the three interdependencies are these. First, the reward of each is dependent upon the choice of all. What each person gets and achieves depends upon everybody's choice, not just their choice. That's the first interdependency. The reward of each depends upon the choices of all. Secondly, the reward of each depends upon the reward of all. In many situations, how much you get depends upon how much other people get. The reward of each depends upon the reward of all. So it's not just that the reward of each depends upon the choice of all, the reward of each depends upon the reward of all. And finally, the choice of each depends upon the choice of all. This, in many contexts, is the most important kind of interdependency, at least for the context we'll be studying. This is interdependencies of choices inside of the act of choosing itself. This interdependency is central to understanding problems of solidarity and working class formation, how the choice of each depends upon the choices of all, and why, therefore, in the question of solidarity, it becomes particularly important how much people trust each other. Because what trust means is that when I make my choices, I have confidence that I already know what choices you are going to make. That's what trust means. Trust is an ability to predict the choices of others, given the choices you're making. Yeah?
Is there any sense as to why he did not include the fourth plausible option, which is the choice of each depends on the reward of all?
It's probably because it's a combination of two of the others. That is, the choice of each depends upon the reward of all is a combination of the choice of each depends upon the choice of all, and the reward of each depends upon the choice of all. If you put those two together, the choice of each depends upon the reward. I think if you put together, I think those three give you that fourth one.
Okay.
That's my off the cuff answer.
Okay.
I think if you formalize these, this is kind of like having four categories and three dummy variables. you know, that the fourth one is merely a form of combination of the previous three. Okay, we're over time. Next time we're going to specifically look at solidarity and how to understand solidarity within this general approach of game theory.